Hello, and welcome to Eyes on Success, a weekly program of information on the ever-changing world of accessibility. Now here are the hosts of this program, Nancy Goodman-Torpey and Peter Torpey.
Hello, I'm Nancy.
And I'm Pete. Well, last week we talked with Michael May, who is founder and CEO of the Sendero Group, and we talked mostly about his Seeing Eye GPS navigation program made for the visually impaired. This week, we're going to talk with Michael about his experiences being blinded at the age of 3 and then regaining some of his sight decades later.
Having lost his vision at such a young age, his visual cortex was only partially developed, so he had to learn some things he never knew, and also how to use what new vision he got. But first for our tip of the week. This week's tip comes from Mike May.
You use the tools for what they're good at, and you recognize their weaknesses.
And I think what Mike's trying to say there is that, you know, there's a variety of tools for doing almost any task. And sometimes you just have to use that variety of tools because some of them complement each other. There isn't always a single tool that accomplishes what you want to do.
And he actually made this comment in an uncommon context, as you'll hear later in this show. But we selected this clip as our tip because it really applies universally.
Baby, get those crying eyes on this tightrope walking, tightrope walking.
Now that's not our normal breaker tune. That was Sarah Beck performing a song that she wrote about Mike May's experience losing and regaining his vision. Turning to our low-tech item, we'll be talking about Mike May's early life as a blind child.
Can you start by introducing yourself to our listeners?
This is Mike May in Davis, California, and I'm president and CEO of Sendero Group.
You're visually impaired, I take it.
Yeah, I've been totally blind since the age of 3, blinded by a chemical explosion in a mining town of Silver City, New Mexico.
Did you have any vision at all?
I had light perception. Both of my eyes were burned, and one of them didn't function at all, and I got a prosthetic in it, and the right eye had a little bit of light perception. That was it. I had 4 operations by the time I was 12, and they kept trying to replace the cornea in that good eye, but they eventually gave up because it was like trying to plant a tree in cement. It's not going to grow if the tissue around the cornea is not healthy, and in my case, it was very scarred.
Mm-hmm. You said you were blind from a very early age. You obviously then learned a lot of these skills in terms of mobility and braille very early in life. Can you describe your childhood a little bit to us?
I grew up in mainstream schools. This is before it really was something that was mandated by the various laws. We had a resource room at a particular school in our county. So all the blind kids, 10 or 12 of us, went to the same school, but we were in with 600 sighted kids, and we had our resource teacher there and learned our braille and mobility and so forth. But then I also got to be on the school sports teams and such.
That must have been interesting. What kind of sports did you play as a blind child?
I loved everything sports, and I think I learned some of my crashing through ways of dealing with life and getting smacked into by different things. I remember at age 5 going out on the playground and wanting to go on the swings and not realizing just where I was, and somebody swinging smashed right into me and knocked some teeth out and me over. And you'd think somebody might learn from that lesson and not go back out on the playground, but I did. I loved tetherball, where you hit the ball around a pole. And then I was on the football team, the flag football team. And that's kind of a tricky thing for a blind person to do. But I learned very quickly that when you pull a flag of the quarterback, that's how you get the person down. That's the equivalent of tackling them. Well, there was no point in trying to figure out who was the quarterback, and I would just pull everybody's flag that I came to. And this became such an intimidating thing for other kids that as I would rush towards them trying to reach for their flags, they would get out of my way, which of course in football is exactly what you want.
So you were a good rusher.
I would get to the quarterback eventually, you know, 1 out of 5 times and create a down. I've always said that when people say, well, how'd you become an entrepreneur? And I thought, well, you know, from age 3, I've had to learn to be adaptable and to find workarounds to things. And that's really started in sports and in school and eventually worked into my career.
When I was in graduate school, we used to play touch football behind the engineering building. And instead of playing the shirts and the skins, I used to be the quarterback with very limited vision. And my team would yell if they wanted to receive the ball. Of course, if the other team wanted an interception, they would yell also.
And apparently, Mike didn't give up sports when he graduated from school. As an adult, he was clocked as the fastest totally blind skier going downhill at 65 miles an hour.
So I would guess you must have gotten a lot of support from your parents. I mean, I often find that, you know, successful folks at that age, you know, a lot of it's due to the encouragement they get from their parents and not over-sheltering them.
Yeah. Well, interestingly, I had really a combination of both. Not being overprotected was a function of the fact that my mom, who became a single mom when I was 13, she had five kids, and you just can't overprotect one kid out of five. It's just physically impossible. Having raised two kids myself, I don't know how anybody deals with that many children. But the good news was that I had to step up to the plate and help with cooking and behave myself and be a leader in the house. And it couldn't be the sort of thing where she or the other kids were pampering me. So that was one thing that was just a matter of circumstances. And then also, of course, through life, my mother was an amazing support and a hero of mine.
I think it's very important to have very supportive parents, and I certainly benefited from that myself.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. Success, 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 success.
This week's focus topic is what it was like for Mike getting some of his vision restored as an adult after decades of blindness. So when you were in your 40s, you had another operation that restored some of your vision. Can you describe what that was like?
So I had no expectation of ever having vision, and it was not part of my makeup, my thinking at all. And my mother was, of course, key in supporting that concept. Go out, learn your alternative tools and techniques, and having vision is not one of the things that you should be thinking about or seeking. So I was really quite shocked when at age 46, I was in a doctor's office with my wife, and she was getting her contacts fixed, and the ophthalmologist in that office said, well, let me, what's your story? And I told him, and he knew the doctor that I'd had since childhood, who had since passed away. And he says, well, let me take a look. And he takes a look. He asks me my history. And he says, you know, we won't know without looking in with some instruments, but it is possible, given new techniques of cornea and stem cell transplants, that we can repair your eye. Possible, not by any means likely, but something to think about. And that's where it all started.
Stem cell treatment was pretty experimental and still is. How did that come about?
So I started learning a little bit about the potential of this operation. And it turns out that at that time, there'd been something like 50 eye stem cell transplants, and only half of those were successful. So there weren't many worldwide to begin with. My doctor had done one or two, I think. So this wasn't a really high likelihood of success. And the measure of success wasn't that they became fully sighted or that they even had sight for an extended period of time. It was just some sight for some period of time. So I'm thinking, you know, I may not get any vision, and then it's going to be costly. It's going to take a lot of time. I got to drive an hour and a half to San Francisco a whole bunch of times through this process. I made a laundry list of 20 reasons not to have this operation, and only had a couple of things on the list of why I should have it. And the top of that list was curiosity. If I don't do this, then I'm never going to know, would it be successful? And being a pioneer, as I like to envision myself, I wasn't being Mike May if I didn't try it. So I was kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. If I did do it, then I had all these other ramifications, including the potential of increased cancer from the immune suppressant drugs and all these other expenses. That was the downside. The upside was I'd find out, would I be successful? And if so, I'd find out what it was like to see. And that tipped the scale.
Yeah, I've heard that was a real risk of some of these stem cell procedures, is that they sometimes just wind up growing too much and develop into cancer-type symptoms. Is that a small probability?
The cancer possibility was from the immune suppressant drugs because it's suppressing your immune reaction so that the stem cells are not rejected. At the same time, it's also suppressing lots of other immune stuff, like your immunity to cancer. So skin cancer is a likely thing to come up. And in fact, I did have a basal cell situation that came up a few years after taking these drugs. So it's a real possibility.
So these are systemic drugs that you take, not just eye drops then?
That's right.
Is that something that continues forever?
It really depends on the case. And in my situation, after about 2 or 3 years, they shut off the immune suppressant drug, the cyclosporin, and I had a really bad reaction and almost lost the eye that they had fixed. They cranked up another drug, so I'm taking two now, and that went on for several years, and then they tapered them off very slowly over a year or so, and eventually I was off safely and without any repercussions. And so today I'm 13 years into this and probably 5 years in without any drugs.
When Mike was deciding whether or not to have his procedure, he looked at all the possible pros and all the possible cons. And Pete, you not so long ago decided to have a cornea transplant. And I guess the way we often make decisions is we look at, well, what's the best that can happen and what's the worst that can happen when you choose either one of the two options. So maybe you can talk a little bit about that decision.
Yeah, that was an interesting decision. I couldn't see anything at all out of one eye, and I had limited vision out of one eye, but the cornea was severely clouded. And I thought, well, gee, maybe I should do this cornea operation. But that eye already had dozens of operations on it, and the chance of things going wrong was very high. And I was afraid I would lose the eye and any vision I had. And I felt that I kind of navigated around work by seeing where the doors and windows were and other signposts around the building and around the outdoors. And I wasn't sure how I would react to losing all of my vision, how much I relied on that. So I actually did a little experiment. I walked around with an eye patch over my eye for 3 or 4 days just to see what life would be like without any vision. Turned out it didn't make any difference. My brain had been filling in these pictures of what I thought I was seeing. I was so familiar with some of these environments that I believed I saw the windows and doors when really I just kind of knew where they were. So it was really an interesting experiment, and I learned a lot about that, and that helped us make the decision to go ahead and try the corneal transplant.
Well, right, because it turned out there wasn't a downside. If you lost your eye, you weren't losing any vision.
So in my case, the decision was a little bit easier, although we came to a surprising answer. So you had the procedure then, and I take it takes a while for the effects to be beneficial. How did that go after the procedure?
The first operation was the stem cell transplant in November of 99, and then nothing happens because I still have a bad cornea. Once that new tissue grows in, then in March of 2000, I have the cornea transplant, and the expectation was that I might have some benefit or we would know within 1 or 2 weeks. So the day after the operation, I went in to have the bandage changed. They took off the bandage, and lo and behold, I was able to see right then and there, and that shocked the doctor and me and everybody else that was around. It just wasn't expected that there'd be any success so quickly.
And how would you describe the level of your vision at this point?
This is a tough question because I have very strange vision. I thought of vision as either high vision, medium vision, total, fully sighted, you know, 3 or 4 increments. And what I learned after going through my experience and talking to vision scientists is that your brain processes vision in all these different sections of the visual cortex. And different sections deal with different things: face recognition, motion detection, color, depth perception, and several more. And it turned out after a couple of years, we learned that I was nearly as good as a fully sighted person in terms of color perception, which was a lot of fun. I had to learn names for colors that I'd forgotten, you know, eggplant, chartreuse, teal. But I can see those colors. And to this day, it's really exciting to be able to sit at a coffee shop and watch people in all these different colored clothing walking by and seeing the lights that are different colors. I was really good at motion detection, so I could catch a ball in the air. However, I could not recognize a face, even if somebody really familiar to me, a foot away or 6 inches away, let alone 2 or 3 feet, you know, normal social acceptable distance away. I could not recognize somebody's face. I couldn't even tell male or female from a face. And I was also really bad at depth perception. I had no 3D. Hence, I learned after a couple of bad tumbles and experiences encountering my face into cement benches that I really needed to stick with a cane or a dog for mobility and use the vision for sightseeing, because I couldn't tell a gray bench from a gray curb or a sidewalk. They all just blended together. Unless there was contrast, I couldn't see these things. So my vision is a very strange combination of being really good in some ways and really bad in others.
Has your brain been able to compensate in some ways after all these years, or it's sort of a static situation?
Well, this was the subject of intense research, and I've been in an fMRI machine dozens of times. And the Vision Sciences in September of 2003 published an article in Nature Neuroscience, which garnered an amazing amount of press around the world, almost more than when I had the operation to begin with. And their conclusion at that point was that MM, being me, as though they were being secretive, would not be able to learn faces or depth perception, that these things were hardwired, they were stuck where they were, and that was that. And the reason for it was that visual development occurs over the first 6 years of your life, and mine was interrupted halfway through that period. Therefore, some things that fully develop earlier, like color perception, were in good shape. Other things that took longer, like face recognition, were cut off before they were complete. And that was their rationale for why I had the vision that I had and why it was unlikely that these aspects of my vision would get better. The amazing thing is that my eyeball, according to the doctor and the actual optics of the retina and the cornea and the contact and all that, my eye would be 20/40, which is plenty good enough to drive a car and read a book, neither of which I can do. So I'm picking up the information in my eye. By the time it gets to the visual cortex, it's not processed completely, and that's where the bottleneck is.
Mm-hmm. But yet, the improved vision must help you in your everyday life to give you some extra cues. You've learned to adapt to the information you do get to make it useful, I guess, right?
Yeah, it took a while for me to learn and use the benefits of the new vision, because it was very overwhelming. And if you do any research or reading about people that have had vision restoration after long-term blindness, you'll see that people had huge issues. Some people had depression, even cases of suicide, mostly unsuccessful experiences with vision recovery. And so I had my degree of being overwhelmed. But what I learned after a couple of years was how to integrate my tools. And this is something I've always touted in terms of adaptive technology, is you use the tools for what they're good at and you recognize their weaknesses. And what I realized was I could use my blindness skills in conjunction with my low vision skills and go to the one that was had a strength in whatever situation was appropriate. And after I figured that out, things worked together nicely and I was much more successful.
Yeah, that's a good thing to learn. I had kind of a similar experience as a youth. I was able to maybe read books by holding them a few inches from my nose. I didn't use a cane, although maybe I should have for crossing streets. But just before I went to graduate school, I had an operation that left me totally blind. And that's when I learned mobility. My eyes started clearing up a bit, so I had some light perception. And when I was learning the cane lessons, I wanted to be blindfolded. And they said, well, no, you have to use everything at your disposal and use these complementary tools to get around and learn how to use these things effectively.
That's it. And you have to learn each tool independently. So my blindness skills were well intact. It took me a while to learn the visual skills And of course, to learn this business about what I was good at, I can see something if it's moving better than if it's stationary. And so that makes a difference. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So now, Pete, getting back to your cornea transplant, I don't remember you having any trouble at all learning how to use what vision you regained. On the other hand, you didn't regain a whole lot of vision, but you were able to visually find an object as large as a car. And I remember it was so exciting the first time we went to spread mulch around the garden, you could actually see the glint of the shovel and find the mulch pile all by yourself. So that was pretty cool.
It's interesting. I think you learn to adapt to those things. If a normally sighted person had all of a sudden had the vision that I had at that point, they wouldn't have been able to know what to do with that vision or how to use it. In fact, they probably would have found it less than useful. But my vision had changed slowly over a number of years, so I had a chance to adapt to these situations and learn how to complement what little vision I had with other skills like listening or counting steps or just being well aware of where I was located in certain environments. And I think many visually impaired people learn to compensate with their other senses, and they learn to use those tools, as Mike says, in conjunction to optimize their situation in ways that sighted people just can't comprehend.
Well, and just like Mike said, you retained all of your blindness skills, and then what little vision got added to the mix, you were able to augment your appreciation of the environment. And so you used your blindness skills with the cane, but you could also have a better idea of where the house was before you actually tapped it.
Has your eyesight stabilized now after the 13 or so years?
My eyesight has really not changed. It hasn't gotten worse. I've had a few little scrapes in terms of infections, but the eyesight hasn't changed that much. The vision scientists continue to test me, and they say that perhaps I'm evolving a little bit of depth perception. Maybe I have 2.5D, not 3D. I'm not sure if that's true or if there's just an excuse so they can keep studying me, because I visit with them a couple times a year. But I think it's more been a matter of me intellectually figuring out how to do things and using this integration effect. That's been really the key to the vision being better now than it used to be. So, for example, if I walk down a sidewalk and I see an object and I think, okay, it's on the sidewalk, contextually, that limits what it is. It's probably not a cow. What could it be in front of me on the sidewalk? Could be a person, could be a bicycle. And I couldn't tell the difference between a person and a bicycle until I look at it for 5-10 seconds. And in the beginning, it would take me longer, at least 10 seconds to figure out and make that decision. Now it would take me 2 seconds. So it's not that my vision's gotten better. It's that my library of information has been increased, and therefore I'm faster at figuring these things out.
Oh, that's very interesting. And I guess being a small number of people that went through this process, people haven't developed means of perhaps training or special things you should do to enhance these capabilities. You just have to learn on your own.
There really is no rehabilitation protocol for this kind of experience because so few people have gone through it, as you say. And in the early days, I remember getting an email from this doctor in Finland and saying, what about your rehab team that's going to walk you through this? And I'm thinking, rehab team? There's nobody that I know in rehab that knows anything about this. I'm talking about my friends and family that are going to work me through this. And that's really how it evolved.
Well, that was also not our usual breaker tune. That was another clip from Sarah Beck singing Crashing Through. And that entire tune can be heard at www.crashingthrough.com. And that's the title of the book written about Mike's experiences on regaining his vision. Now, there was a book written about you and your experience. Is that still available?
It was a book written about me. It came out in 2007. It's called Crashing Through, It was a bestseller in 2007, in the top 50 books sold on Amazon in 2007. And it was written by Robert Kurson, K-U-R-S-O-N. It, of course, first came out in hardback and then eventually in paperback, which is still available. And, of course, in all the different audio formats on Bookshare and Talking Book Library and a Braille version, I believe, from National Braille Press or APH. I've forgotten which one. So it's everywhere and in all the different formats. And you can get more information about that and links to these different sources for the book at crashingthrough.com.
And actually, crashingthrough.com takes you to a sub-site of Sendero Group's website at senderogroup.com.
So you might want to read Mike's book to learn a little bit more details about his transition through this experience of being blinded for decades and then all of a sudden regaining some of his sight. It was a very interesting transition.
And we will have links to the various ways of getting to the book in the show notes associated with this show on our website at www.eyesonsuccess.net. You said that the main reason you decided to go ahead with the procedure was curiosity. Was your curiosity satisfied? And I guess, are you happy with what you learned?
I learned so much more than I ever expected. I had no idea of this whole vision science part of the equation. I had a glimmer of this sort of thing, but nothing that was anywhere close to what I've experienced now that I've been with vision scientists. I've been in the fMRI machine. I've been involved in the papers that have been published, and it's really become almost a second profession. I've gone to conferences where I'm the only non-PhD present, and all of these really brilliant scientists that have been studying vision for years are quizzing me, asking me questions. I went to this medical institute in London, and they flew in vision scientists from around Europe. And I sat around this long conference table with all these different accented people asking me questions, grilling me for 3-4 hours straight. And it was absolutely fascinating to be involved in this and to be in a front row seat figuring out about this new vision experience, and it just happened to be about me that we were talking.
Well, I guess your story really shows us what a remarkably complex and sophisticated system the human vision and brain interaction is. Thank you.
That's it for show number 1351. Next week on Eyes on Success, we'll be doing our year-end special. And this time it will be about the technology behind Eyes on Success. Several listeners have asked about how we create the show. Well, we'll explain how we do everything from selecting topics and guests to recording and editing to posting the podcasts and maintaining our web presence, including the tools and techniques that we use. And we'll even give a sneak preview of what's planned for 2014. If you have any questions regarding something you've heard about on the show, or you'd like to share an idea for a future show, send an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net or call us at 585-258-0333, and we'll try to address your question in an upcoming program.
You've been listening to Eyes on Success, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman Torpey and Peter Torpey and distributed by WXXI Reach Out Radio. For detailed information or a full archive of programs, visit www.eyesonsuccess.net. You can also follow us on Facebook and Audioboo at Eyes on Success and on Twitter at @_EyesOnSuccess. We hope you will join us again next week for more information and updates on products for accessible living. Thanks for listening to Eyes on Success, and have a nice day.